This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Howard Center provides services to over 15,000 Vermonters every year. More than 8,000 people are actual clients of the center. The executive director, Todd Centebear, is responsible for running the largest social services organization in the state. It's one of the state's largest employers, and he is in charge of an operating budget of more than $81 million. Centebear is retiring later this month after 40 years at the center. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk with him about what he sees as the center's successes and where he feels like the state's mental health, substance abuse, and developmental services are falling short and perhaps failing Vermonters. Todd Centebear, welcome back to Vermont Edition. Nice to talk with you again.
Nice to talk with you again, Jane.
When you look at what the Howard Center does in the community, it's kind of a mind-boggling array of programs and services, from a program for people who are drunk or high and in need of a place to sober up for the night, to services for young people with autism spectrum disorders, to crisis beds for people with mental health issues, to opiate addiction treatment like methadone, middle and high school students for school for students with behavioral problems or special needs. You provide family counseling. You have drug treatment court. I mean, I could go on for another 5 minutes just of the list of things that are on your website that the Howard Center does. How does one organization deal with all of that?
I don't know.
Well,
you're right. And you've reminded me, I'll start with just a little vignette that I've told a few occasions. You know, my dad, and thank you for saying my name right, by the way. He was the youngest of 13 and the only one who spelled it that way. So I'm sure there's some deep psychological meaning around that.
But how did everybody else spell it?
Centerbar.
Oh.
His story is that when he went in the service in World War II, it got spelled wrong on forms and he could never get it changed. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But, every year, and my dad, both my dad and mom were Vermonters. I grew up in the old North End for many years up on M1 Avenue and Interval Avenue. they moved to Montpelier for better jobs. And at Thanksgiving, and I'd been at Howard Center for many years and become director. And every year on cue at Thanksgiving, he used to say at the dinner table, "Todd, tell me again what it is you really do down there." And in some ways, that's very telling. I mean, it speaks to the breadth, certainly, that you just mentioned. But it also speaks to something else, which is largely we don't, Howard Center, but organizations like ours, we aren't very good about communicating in the way that we need to people who support us and people we serve and people who fund us. Sort of that elevator speech or ski lift speech, if you want to use Vermont language. It's very difficult because we literally do touch many people's lives in the community from birth to death in terms of what we do. And some people have described us kind of as one of the best kept secrets in Chittenden County. And I certainly feel that way. I think we have intentionally for the last many months really begun to focus on what do we really need to do better to tell our story and really give people a sense, not just of what we do, but if you're going to invest your time, your money, your support with us or other social service organizations in the community, many of whom we all do good work, we want to know, is it really making a difference? And I think we've got to do a better job at responding to that in some very specific ways. I think we do. We can talk about some of those things today if you like. But that's our job. And I feel very good, in fact, when looking into it, that we have made a difference for many years. The agency started after the Civil War. And of our, I don't know how many locations, different sites we have now, most of them are small sites, but mid-50s to say 59 locations. One of them is at the cemetery out on the old by the high school. And if you walk through there, some of the graves you can see are children and orphans from the Civil War. And that's really how the organization got started many, many years ago. And that was really reinforced when we merged with then the Baird Center for Children and Families and Champlain Drug and Alcohol.
And you haven't been around for quite that long.
some may think I have.
But you have been with the organization for 40 years now. I mean, that's a long tenure for anybody to stay at one organization.
Yes, it is. It's certainly, in terms of today's statistics, if you look at how many people are staying in organizations and, you know, have five or six employers over the course of even the beginnings of their career, it is. And I think I probably would not have been there that long except for two things. One, and this applies, I think, pretty much to everyone who works at the Howard Center or like organizations. It resonates a bit with who you are, or in colloquial parlance, helps you become the person your dog thinks you are. So it is much, I think, a selfish endeavor as it is one of trying to give something to others. You have to have compatible values. And that's really why people stay with Howard. It certainly, as we can talk about, one of our challenges, but it's not for the money and it's not for the pay.
We're talking with Todd Centivere. He's the executive director of the Howard Center. And as I mentioned, he's been with the organization for 40 years now and is leaving at the end of December. You know, we talked a little bit about some of the range of programs that Howard Center provides. If you distill it down, basically, Howard Center is a designated agency, one of 16 in the state, and your charge is to help deal with substance abuse issues, mental health issues, and help people with developmental disabilities lead productive and successful lives. And so most of your programs are geared around those areas. You mentioned that you need to find a better way to tell that story, but you think that you're making a difference in people's lives. Is there one story of an individual or a program in particular that you think about when you think of a success story or something that has made a difference in people's lives?
I think of one. There are many, but one that I think personally applies to me. And it has different messages. And you described our mission, by the way, very well. Thank you. I started at the agency, as you said, in 1975, and worked mostly nights, weekends, holidays, doing substance abuse. I had come from a job with the state as one of the mental health probation officers at the time, which was a novel concept then. I not too long before that gotten out of the service. I was a lieutenant working in a Army medical hospital in Fort Sam Houston, Texas, and became fascinated with really with people who were dealing with situations in their life that were what we would describe today as chronic. They're lifelong, that required digging deep and finding a certain amount of will, courage to go on, and in spite of what for many of us would seem insurmountable problems. And so early on when I had started, I was actually doing some outpatient therapy then. And I got a call from the front desk. And they said, somebody's down here looking for help, a walk-in person. And would you mind seeing them? And the person, say George, talked about his home life collapsing, two young children, wife threatening to divorce him. And that he had reached that moment in his life where he just he didn't know where to turn, and it turned out part of the root of his problem had to do with some substance abuse pieces, and that day I was able to get him into you would call it an intervention. Into our social detoxification program. And then from there, he went to a short-term residential program and then some outpatient therapy. The reason that story is – it's a typical one. The reason it's important to me personally is that every year for 15 to 16 years after that, he would come in on that same date, July 8th. And I would make sure that I was working on that day. Every year he would come in, we'd chat, we'd have a cup of coffee, and he would say thank you, and he'd talk about his life. And it was humbling because I really felt I didn't do anything. And I don't say that to be modest. I mean, it could almost have been a stuffed animal sitting in my seat. I happened to be at the right place at the right time with the right information and was able to give that person who was ready for something. It was all about him. He was ready. He was acknowledging he needed help. And that, I think, applies to a lot of the work that we do, whether it's in substance abuse or someone suffering from depression or families who are desperate. And the part about being humble, I think, is important because without it, you really don't appreciate – can't appreciate the strengths that people do have and bring to the table when you're working with them. It's not about giving people answers or telling them what to do. It's helping them, being there for them, and providing hope as well as some professional help.
Well, let's talk more about that. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to look at how an organization like the one that you have been running can be in the right time at the right place with the right services for everybody who needs them without overspending and on a limited budget and a budget where you often see cuts. So how does an organization do that? And now that you're leaving, you don't have to pull any punches. You can tell us exactly what you think would work and doesn't work and what the solution is, because we continue to see people in need of services, people suffering from long wait times and money that is tough to come by. We're talking with Todd Centebear. He's the executive director of Howard Center, the state's largest mental health and substance abuse service organization. We're going to have more with him in just a moment. And listeners, if you have questions or if you'd like to share a thought or a story, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post those questions at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're spending time with Todd Centebear. He's worked at the Howard Center in Burlington for 40 years, and he's retiring at the end of this month. We're going to get his thoughts on changes in treatment methods and philosophy for mental health and substance abuse. And we'll also look ahead at how changes in the way healthcare is paid for might affect the clients he works with and our ability to treat people in a timely manner. If you have a question for Todd Centebear, call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. For our mental health and substance abuse systems, where do you see things working? Where do you see them falling down? And what would you like to know about what might work in the future? Again, go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. One of the things we kept hearing last year, Todd, as we looked at the way that the state's mental health system was working, was that the opening of a new acute psychiatric care facility in Berlin would lessen the load on everybody in the mental health system, because people who needed acute care would have this facility that would open up new beds. And that would lessen the load on some of the other hospitals and perhaps allow people to have more time to spend with people who are not in acute crisis. Mm-hmm. Has that happened since the opening of that facility?
I think it has. At the same time, I don't think it's happened as rapidly as people had hoped and expected. There still is, in fact, a number of new units at the new acute care facilities in Berlin that aren't opened up yet. So I think when those beds open up, hopefully we'll see some continued relieve some of the pressure in the communities. There are still some waits longer than should be in emergency rooms. I know Commissioner Dupre and other folks from the state are very sensitive to that and working hard around placement. One of the struggles around that is they're really – as of yet, is not, in my opinion, an effective care management system in place. There's some good people working very hard, But we really we have a lot of people working very hard, but working really in absence of a defined care management system, then in a much more formal way, driven by some protocols and best practice, really is kind of moving people through the pipeline. Because when you, as you know, folks are kind of stuck longer than they should be or need to be in particularly in acute care beds, which are also, by the way, the higher cost parts of our system. That means there's a backup somewhere else, traffic jam. And so
you mean because they can't get into a residential care system or into an outpatient treatment program that might work for them?
Exactly. Exactly. So so there's still some work that certainly needs to be done there. I think there are some bright spots, though. I'd like to mention that for a minute, and then certainly talk about where I think we have some real problems. I talked about our services really making a difference, and there are different ways to measure that. And by the way, I think one of the hopeful pieces is that designated agencies, specialized service agencies, those agencies that have a special relationship with the state, really are coming together under Vermont Care Partners, one element, and really are committed to functioning not just as a coordinated set of agencies, but really as a system of care. So what does that mean? It means you decide together what needs to be done, what the best practices are that you're going to follow, and hold yourselves accountable in a public way to really putting the numbers out there of are you making a difference. One way of measuring that, and of many that we use at the Howard Center that I feel gratified with, and we just did this, 93% of the folks who received said they received the help they wanted. 93% said the services were right for them. 92% said the services we provided actually did make a difference in their lives. And 97% said they felt they were treated with respect. Those aren't the only ways, obviously, to decide are you making a difference. But from the point of view of people we serve, our customers, if you will, I think those are pretty powerful numbers that I think are not – I mean, I don't take credit for them, but I think our staff and the caring that they provide, really, they should feel proud of the work that they do.
Those are pretty remarkable numbers in terms of when people can get in and get treatment and get services, that they're feeling that level of satisfaction. Mm-hmm. But what about how difficult it is to serve everybody who actually wants to get treatment? And I realize that in many cases, although certainly not all, we're talking about two sort of different waiting list areas here. We're talking about substance abuse, people who are waiting to get treatment for things like methadone. And then there's also people who are waiting to get treatment for mental health issues. In both cases, is there still a long waiting list of people who need help or want help but can't get it? I mean, I understand if you are suicidal and you need treatment, you can often get it right then. But if you just need some ongoing treatment and you are not in a crisis, are you waiting a long time to get mental health treatment from Howard Center and other designated agencies in the state?
At Howard Center, the answer is largely no, you're not waiting a long time. But there are some critical gaps. You're correct around substance abuse, and I'll just mention because it's a current topic around the substance abuse piece. Our opiate-related medication-assisted treatments programs are still – our waiting list is down to about 270 what we call active – it's an active waiting list. And so what does that mean? It means that these are people who we have actually already done a pre-screening on. We know they could benefit from treatment and they're interested in treatment, but we don't have the resources available to provide it. So – folks who are on the inactive list, it's difficult to know who's out there. So we still have a big challenge in terms of really being able to meet treatment on demand. Part of our obligation under this so-called designated status with the state in terms of other services is that we agree for largely a capitated amount of money. There's some exceptions, but we only get a certain amount of money every – we have to earn it. It's not like the legislature or the government drops off a bag of money. And part of our responsibility around that is to provide treatment to everyone who comes to us, regardless of their ability to pay. That's one of the things that makes us different. And we do that. We've been innovative at Howard Center, particularly in our around some of our outpatient waiting list pieces, in that you can get treatment pretty much on demand in terms of an appointment. It's sort of like, well, can you wait? Can you not wait? We've really blended a combination of our crisis response team and our outpatient team to really to provide increased access capability. There are some areas, though, where there are critical shortages. One is around the ability to see a psychiatrist. If you need that kind of intervention or professional service outside of an emergency situation where we can provide it, and we have a relationship with the hospital to be able to do that, you can wait a long time. There's a real shortage of psychiatry in the state, and largely that's because of reimbursement problems. The cost to provide the care is much greater than we get reimbursed for. That's one area. Some parts of the state, by the way, child psychiatry is even you're good luck if you can find it. Hopefully, it advances around telepsychiatry, and some of those kinds of things can help with that situation. If you have a severe and persistent mental illness, we can see you. Vermont generally is very good that way, providing those kinds of services for people getting out of hospitals or other types of care. But at the present time, and this gets into some of the problems we have, just looking at Howard Center, we have approximately 150 positions that are vacant. That are open.
You mean for hiring, for staff?
For hiring. Not all of those are full-time, but a goodly number are. So why? And it's because people come. They want to work with us. They like the organization. They like the values. They like the mission. Many people can't afford to make a career with us long-term. They don't get paid enough money. Some have to take second, third jobs. Particularly if you're working part-time. That, in my opinion, statewide is the largest problem looming for our system. The business model, if we want to use those terms, the way that the system is operated, largely very well for the citizens of Vermont for many years, is breaking down, in my opinion. I'm not saying that that everything will collapse tomorrow, but there's very specific data to indicate that we are on a down slope that can have serious consequences. And for example,
are we talking about separate things here? Sorry to interrupt you, but when we talk about the staffing, you have 140 or so open positions.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, as you've said, is because people don't get paid enough. I mean,
that's right.
My understanding as well is that if you can throw some money at a psychiatrist if you can get one to come to the state. But if you're a social worker, you're not going to get paid very well. I mean, that's just the way it is, right? So is that one of the issues with staffing? And so finding a way to make sure that the pay structure for people who work in this field mm-hmm. is adequate is a big challenge. And that's tied to, but not not 100% equating to also the reimbursement structure for services that you provide. So are there sort of different areas where the system is breaking down financially?
Yeah, there are. We I should say probably somewhere around 80% of our total budget is driven by Medicaid. There's some Medicare, there's private insurance, there's some self-pay, but by and large, the driver is Medicaid. And as most folks probably know, it requires a state appropriation, and then you can draw down some as match money for federal dollars. Let's take two positions of sort of the state, because there's been a lot of talk lately about, for example, putting more resources into children's services in the state, DCF. A social worker working for Department of Children and Families at the state level doing pretty much the same kind of work that an equivalent licensed position would get for working in a community health, mental health organization. It's about a $10,000 difference.
In which direction?
Yeah, the state pays more. And I use the state as an example, not to say they're overpaid by any means, but if you talk about parity, and the state is not even our largest competitor. If you talk about Fletcher Allen, you talk about the University of Vermont, you talk about other places that, that recruit folks, the pay level is much higher. That contributes to why you have positions, so many positions open. In some cases in the children's world, we actually where schools are saying, we want your services. We have children who need your services. We actually have room under our Medicaid cap, so it's not a matter of are the dollars available, but we can't hire the staff at a level that they need to take the job. To fill the positions because you can't say, well, Todd, we're going to pay you more because you happen to work in a program that is Medicaid reimbursable. And Jane, we're sorry, you might work in the same room right next door, but you don't work in a program where you don't get Medicaid. Sorry, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to pay you as much. You can't run a business that way any more than the state could run a business by saying, well, you know, you're a state trooper, you work in Lamoille County. We're going to pay you this amount, but you know, you work in the southern part of the state. We're going to pay you more. It's a similar, I think, kind of analogy that to run the organization, you really have to know how to run a business.
Well, so that's talking about, you know, how reimbursement then affects what you can pay people who work in your organization. We have about 3 minutes left, and I'd love for you to get into what you think might work or not work in terms of fixing the system and how we pay for it. If you're going to provide and people think that we should provide the services that you do for people who are dealing with mental health issues, substance abuse issues, or developmental disabilities, what's your big picture look at what needs fixing and what's working?
Yeah. The big picture for me is, and I am optimistic about this, which may sound a bit surprising. Even though the trend is downward, even though, you know, we know next year, maybe even the year after, Vermont receipts are a problem. And good people, and they're good people. This is not a political thing. We're fortunate in Vermont to have good people on both sides of the aisle who really do care about human services. Historically, we haven't. There's been some changes depending upon administrations and politics, but largely not material in terms of how we're reimbursed. The optimism has to comes from me in the area of healthcare reform. Healthcare reform provides the opportunity, and I use the word health in a broad sense to include developmental disabilities and other things. The language now being used is called social determinants of care, which are really significant drivers of healthcare costs. And in fact, if you look at mental health issues and others, they are only second in terms of cost after cardiovascular diseases and some neurobiological diseases in terms of drivers of cost. So this isn't just about doing things because it's the right thing to do. It's also doing things to change because it's a necessary thing to do if we're to bend the healthcare curve. So how do we transition from a system we have now that is largely very temporal, and that is each legislative session, depending upon the flavor of the moment, and I don't mean that word in a disparaging way, but needs that arise that are not usually based on analysis of cost or strategic analysis of need, but things of the moment, maybe a crisis has happened, whatever it might be. To really, first of all, saying what is it we really need? Let's not be in denial about strategically where we need to go. Then, in terms of planning, I think it's looking at what do services really cost? Where do we feel we can really make an impact? There's some specific things around changing some of the siloed issues of the way that the system reimburses things. I think linking to work the Green Mountain Care Board is doing. All of this, just to try and close it down, all of this really has to do with forming local systems of care, I think, ultimately, and working with our other community partners. As all politics are local, we could argue that good health care will be local. That means home health agencies, areas, Office on Aging, VNAs, where we really come together in an integrated way, and I use the word integrated because it has to be more than just coordinated. then I think we will be able to move in a way that recognizes parity to align the systems better to deliver good care.
So local works, just figuring out a way to pay for it.
Yes, and there's one thing the state should do. There's an opportunity, a great opportunity for Vermont to be one of eight demonstration projects that in essence will allow funding for designated agencies, much like community health centers are funded. Vermont needs to apply for it. They're dragging their feet a little bit, and they need to get on with it.
Todd Centebear is executive director of Howard Center. He'll be retiring at the end of this month after about 40 years working there. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Fairpoint Communications has been in the news a lot lately. First, the company's unionized workers went on strike in October after months of negotiations failed to produce a new contract. Then the Vermont Public Service Department asked the Public Service Board to investigate the increasing number of delays in repairing residential landline problems. And last week, storm damage and an equipment failure caused an outage of Vermont's emergency 911 system, which Fairpoint has taken over under a new contract with the state. VPR Steve Zind has been following these stories and other developments with Fairpoint, and he joins us now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Jane.
So union members in northern New England have been on strike since October 17th. Can you just recap how we got to this point with them first?
Well, the contract actually expired in August, and anticipating that, the union and Fairpoint have been in talks or were in talks beginning in the spring, but really made no progress. And the contract expired. The union really thought long and hard, I think, about whether to strike and finally made that determination, as you said, on October 17th. And then following that, Fairpoint said it was basically – I should say before that, Fairpoint had imposed the conditions it wanted out of a new contract on union members. Following the strike, then the health care benefits for health care coverage for workers was suspended. And since October 17th, there's only been one meeting of the two parties, and that was at the behest of a federal mediator, and it was very short-lived. And basically, there was no movement, apparently, and no new meetings. I checked as recently as this morning are scheduled at this point.
So this strike ongoing, you know, and no sign of ceasing at this point.
Yeah, I think the parties are really quite far apart. I had a Fairpoint representative describe it as a very wide chasm between their two positions. And frankly, you know, it's kind of difficult to imagine, given the statements they've made all along, how they're going to reconcile those differences.
So, Steve, this strike has been going on, as we mentioned, since mid-October. And then these other issues that have come up, increasing number of delays in repairing residential landline issues, and this problem, this outage with the emergency 911 system, which resulted in calls getting not answered by emergency services last week. Are they all related to the strike?
I think it's safe to say, Jane, that the strike and the repair delays are related. You know, the standard that Fairpoint is supposed to meet requires them to make telephone repairs, and this just applies to telephone, not broadband, within 24 hours to residential lines. There are 10 service metrics that Fairpoint is supposed to meet. And to be fair, this is the only one they haven't met, but it's a very important one. And they failed to meet it for quite a while now. And the Public Service Department says when the strike happened, an unacceptable level of complaints and service-related problems went even higher. There was a spike. So I think it's safe to connect the fact the strike happened with that spike in complaints and in unresolved issues around residential line repairs. Fairpoint, you know, has made assurances that the replacement workers they've hired will get the job done. But frankly, there's no evidence of that happening at this point.
And you don't think it's fair to connect this E911 outage?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no indication that there's a connection at this point. There's no suggestion from the Public Service Department or the E911 board that service problems led to the 911 outage. But, you know, the department has asked the board to look into that along with these service issues that we've been describing. So maybe something will emerge from that investigation.
Can you explain, Steve, why the Public Service Board might be looking into the repair delay issue? I mean, explain why the state needs to get involved in that. Why, for example, it isn't the case where customers just leave a company that can't provide good customer service in a timely manner, and then the company either fixes itself or goes out of business. Why? So explain why the state has to get involved.
Well, Fairpoint is essentially the incumbent landline operator for northern New England, for Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire. And while, you know, part of their problem is that many customers have been deserting landline service in favor of cellular service, I think 30-some-odd percent, the last figure I heard, of Vermonters no longer have any landline. They just have cell phone service. So that's been a big business problem for Fairpoint. But still, there are, you know, a significant number of people who have no telephone access other than through Fairpoint service. So it's an important issue for the state if it wants to make sure that everyone has access to telephone service.
And on the issue of the E911 outage, what is the board likely to look into on that, and how might it fix it?
You know, I'm not quite clear on that, because in the Public Service Department's petition, it doesn't really, you know, it's very specific in outlining these service problems we've been talking about. But then at the end of the petition, it just says, and there was an E911 failure last Friday, and that endangered public safety. But it doesn't really say we think that failure was due to service issues or to something that Fairpoint could have prevented. Again, there were two issues with the outage. One had to do with a tree over a fiber optic line. The other was an equipment failure. And between them, they took out both the primary circuit and the backup secondary circuit that is used for the E911 system.
And we should say this didn't just affect Fairpoint.
If you're talking about the other service provider in Entrato,
we're
in a transition period essentially where Fairpoint has won the contract and officially formally took over operation of Vermont's E911 system earlier this year. But there is a transition, so Entrato is still involved. And we should say there was a very similar outage in August when Entrato was the company that was responsible. And in that case, they also lost the primary and backup system. So this isn't a first.
Steve, going back to what we were talking about earlier, the strike that's been ongoing since the middle of October for Fairpoint union members in northern New England, you mentioned that there's no end in sight to that at the moment. That seems pretty intractable. So what's the impact for Fairpoint Communications if no settlement is reached?
You know, it's interesting because ironically, it seems like these are two parties who need each other. The workers need these good jobs. Fairpoint, if you're going to judge by these service problems, needs the workers. But Fairpoint could simply stick to the position it's had ever since negotiations began. And if union members don't agree to all these concessions, they could be out of jobs. So there's a lot at stake for the union. There's certainly a public relations war that's going on right now that I think is designed to maybe bring to bear some pressure on Fairpoint stockholders, its investors, to bring pressure on the company and say, hey, you've got all these problems. This isn't good for our investment. Maybe you should make some concessions and settle. But at this point, it's really difficult to tell how this is going to end.
VPR Steve Zind has been following developments at Fairpoint Communications and will continue to do so. You can find his stories and continuing coverage at vpr.net. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Jane.
And that will do it for today's show. Yesterday on the program, we spoke with St. Michael's College physics professor John O'Mara about the launch of NASA's Orion space vessel. As you may have heard, that launch was scheduled to happen this morning, but was called off due to high winds and to a boat that strayed into the launch zone. NASA has tentatively scheduled the launch for tomorrow morning, and Professor O'Mara let us know his plans for a launch party are still in place. If you'd like to watch the launch on a big screen, you can find more information on our website, vpr.net. And tomorrow on the program, state revenues are falling behind projections and Vermont is staring at a potential $100 million deficit. We'll speak with the Secretary of Administration, Jeb Spaulding, and Finance Commissioner Jim Reardon about plans to eliminate the deficit and at how budget cuts might affect people who rely on state assistance. If you have questions about the deficit, send them to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Isla Yersel. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.